You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. A new 60-unit workforce apartment complex in Manzanita is on track for a September grand opening. Manzanita has long lacked affordable and workforce housing options. Developed by Home First Development Partners, the Spruce Point project has received a $21.4 million grant from Oregon Housing and Community Services, as well as multiple grants from the Tillamook County Affordable Housing Grant Program. At Spruce Point, 48 of the apartments will be designated as low income, and 12 as extremely low income. The complex consists of three three-story buildings and two two-story buildings, as well as a clubhouse with a community gathering area and offices for staff. In addition to Spruce Point, plans are underway for a second 72-unit complex. This story is brought to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com.
Incumbent Pacific County Sheriff Daniel Garcia is facing fierce competition in his bid for re-election next month. The Republican is vying for the seat against Sean Eastham, an EMT and active deputy with the department, Rich Bird, who spent more than 20 years with the sheriff's office, and David Podesta, who served 30 years in the Los Angeles Police Department. Bird and Eastham are registered as independents. Podesta is registered as a Republican. Pacific County Voices United hosted two candidate forums with the men earlier this month, before ballots are set to be mailed out for the August 4th primary election. None of the candidates supported a hypothetical state-mandated gun buyback or confiscation. All four candidates agreed more needs to be done to address drug crimes and mental health crises. Garcia defended his decision to not seek continued state funding for the Pacific County Drug Task Force, saying that the department needs to reshape the way they go about drug crimes while dealing with the state's budget crunch. Bird said there's room in the budget for the Drug Task Force and that if elected, he would one day bring the Drug Task Force back. Eastham echoed this, calling it irresponsible to not pursue additional legislative funding for community members experiencing addiction. Asked about support for Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, Podesta said the sheriff's office does not have the authority to intervene on federal matters, and it's the sheriff's office job to make sure civilians do not interfere. Byrd pledged to take care of his local citizens first before worrying about a federal entity. Eastham said he would support ICE. Garcia said he would work with ICE to make sure what they're doing is legal. When asked about staffing and budget, Garcia said he would like to bring on more deputies, while Bird and Podesta said if elected, they would work with the staff they had. The two candidates who receive the most votes in August will advance to the November general election. This story is brought to us by a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. The Swinomish and Squaxin Island tribes are suing the Trump administration. They want to protect the places where endangered species live. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
I caught up with Steve Edwards while he was out fishing on Bellingham Bay.
As many tribes in Washington, salmon is our way of life.
But like many tribal members, the Swinomish tribal chair has had to switch from catching salmon to Dungeness crab.
Crabbing is big for us, but that doesn't mean that we forget about salmon.
There just aren't enough salmon anymore. Several stocks are listed as endangered species. Tribes have poured money into restoring their habitat. Now they're trying to force federal agencies to keep protecting endangered species habitats. Their lawsuit comes after the Trump administration reinterpreted the Endangered Species Act. Federal policy now is that harming habitat doesn't harm species that live there. The administration says its approach respects private property and business interests. Scientists say it's not possible to save endangered species if you don't also save their habitats. I'm John Ryan reporting.
Organizers in Bellingham have collected enough signatures for a new initiative to ban rental pricing software. The initiative is aimed at software companies that analyze market data and suggest rental prices to landlords. In recent years, the technology has drawn scrutiny from the Department of Justice and allegations of price fixing. Cleveland Harris is the chair of Community First WhatCom, the group that gathered signatures for the initiative.
This is not how we should be using this technology if we're using it. Like, you know, it just like feels like another way to, you know, already extract or squeeze out more from folks who are, you know, price burdened already.
Harris says it's hard to tell exactly how many landlords in Bellingham are currently using the technology. The initiative follows a bill to ban price-setting software statewide that failed to pass earlier this year. The Bellingham City Council plans to vote July 27th on whether to pass the initiative into law or send it to voters. A vote on what Democrats call the millionaire's tax will probably be on your ballot in the fall. Democrats and their allies are launching a campaign to save it. KUOW's Scott Greenstone has more.
Governor Bob Ferguson spoke at a press conference Tuesday saying voters should keep an income tax on the state's wealthy because of what it would fund.
Our K-12 education system will see massive investments to keep our classes small and provide opportunities for young people all across our state. Nearly 500,000 families in Washington state will receive a working families tax credit.
Opponents say the tax will drive out wealth and jobs. Over 500,000 voters signed a petition to put a repeal of the tax on the November ballot, according to Let's Go Washington, the group behind the repeal. Influential unions representing state employees, teachers, healthcare, and childcare workers are dumping millions into the campaign to save the tax. If they fail, the state's budget hole could force layoffs of their dues-paying members. I'm Scott Greenstone in Seattle.
Artificial intelligence is evolving rapidly, and many local governments are trying to figure out how or if they should be using it. In Snohomish County, local leaders are trying a new experiment by convening what's known as a civic assembly. It's an uncommon model of direct democracy. For 3 weekends this spring, they tasked 29 randomly selected county residents with deliberating on AI and coming up with policy recommendations. KNKX's Murrow News fellow Nate Sanford went inside the entire process.
Last year, I wrote a series of articles about how local government workers in Everett had used ChatGPT for a variety of tasks. The series raised questions about transparency, and it also caught the eye of local leaders in Snohomish County.
That reporting actually was the thing that kicked off the civic assembly on this particular issue.
Jillian Youngblood is the director of Civic Genius, the group facilitating the assembly in Snohomish County. Youngblood says the goal is to empower everyday people to help create policies.
They can learn about something, discuss it in good faith with other people in their communities, and have a tangible impact on government.
Members of the Snohomish County Council say they'll take the assembly's recommendations seriously and consider adopting them into law. But before that can happen, 29 random Snohomish County residents will need to find consensus on how they want their government to use AI. It's a tall order. On the first weekend, Youngblood addresses the group inside a classroom at Washington State University's Everett campus.
And we're all on totally different learning curves here. So I know folks who came in not sure what an LLM was. And then there are folks here who are AI professionals and everything in between.
It feels a bit like jury duty. The assembly members were chosen to be demographically representative. Among the group, there's a police officer in training, a tech worker, a retired engineer, a social worker, and a middle school teacher. They're being paid $500 for their time.
I really like the input that you had on this one.
There are a few distinct camps forming among the participants. Some say they don't want to see their government using AI at all. Jessica Rhodes is a behavioral specialist at an elementary school.
I mean, I really wanted to do this just because I am very against AI, and I'm very against what it's doing to our environment, and I think that as a nation, we are getting way too ahead of ourselves.
Other participants have a more optimistic view. Drew Vrytita is a software engineer.
I use AI for my work on a daily basis, so I came in with a very a tech-first mindset to these things.
After hearing presentations from AI experts in tech and law, the participants break into groups and start researching how Snohomish County government already uses AI. To allow for candid discussions, I agreed to not use people's names when recording the small group conversations. One group is surprised to learn that the county uses an AI tool called Cora to assist its 911 operators.
So you call 911 and it sends you right into an AI?
No, but you still talk to a person.
Again, 911 operators still answer the phones in Snohomish County, and Cora just helps them with what to ask during calls. But this group is worried about what would happen if AI replaces operators entirely.
Yeah. Because of emergency, it feels like you'd want to trust a human mind to do it.
And there could be implicit bias, because if we're taking in data from medical records, we know that women don't get recognized for having heart attacks for the same records as men.
So as the second weekend begins, the participants are back in groups, doing an exercise called civic theater.
Is there anything else I can help you with? I don't think you understand. This person might need help right now. Can I talk to a supervisor?
They're acting out imagined scenarios related to the AI issues they're discussing.
If this is a life-threatening emergency, please hang up and dial 911.
Oh, you're not human. Of course, can I please talk to a person?
A freeze!
After acting out a few more scenarios, the participants break into small groups and try coming up with conditions for the county's use of AI. Participant Hillary Morales says there are a few common ideas that everyone in the Civic Assembly seems to agree on.
I'm really liking the fact that pretty much everybody hates AI calls. That's like the biggest thing I've seen is everybody's like, I never want to talk to a robot. I think we'll see the end of it with this council. I think we've done it. We've killed AI callers.
The participants are also agreeing on big themes like transparency, accountability, and privacy. Consensus is starting to emerge, but the ideas are still a long way from actual policies. We'll get to that in part two. I'm Nate Sanford, reporting.
Two of Oregon's oldest private universities are closer to becoming one institution. Willamette and Pacific University's governing bodies approved an agreement to merge the two schools this month. Jenny Cole is the president of Pacific University. She says in the near term, students might not see many changes.
Pacific students are still going to be Pacific students. Willamette students will be Willamette students. But really what we're signaling is that we're going to offer more for students.
Leaders at both schools say students will have access to more resources like career counseling and a larger alumni network. The university's merger must still get state and federal approvals. It could take up to 2 years for the consolidation to complete. A statewide initiative to revitalize Oregon's semiconductor industry is getting a boost up to $160 million. OPB's Tiffany Kamhai has more on the National Science Foundation grant awarded Tuesday.
The goal of the Frontiers of Advanced Semiconductor Technology Project, or FAST, is to grow and stabilize Oregon's tech sector. Semiconductor manufacturing is one of the state's key industries, but it's suffered from both layoffs and a shortage of skilled workers. Rob Stone is FAST's interim CEO.
This is about creating opportunities for students, researchers, entrepreneurs, and workers across the region. It's also about strengthening workforce pathways, helping startups and small businesses grow, and ensuring that more Oregonians can participate in one of the world's most important industries.
Oregon State University is leading the effort. The project includes nearly 100 partners, including colleges, state agencies, tech companies, and community organizations. I'm Tiffany Kamhai, reporting.
Washington Governor Bob Ferguson is proposing a new graduation requirement for high school seniors. In order to get a diploma, he believes students should have to fill out the Federal Financial Aid Form, FAFSA, or the Washington State equivalent. Ferguson says many students don't pursue post-high school education programs because they assume they will be too expensive. University of Washington Tacoma student Heba Kutrani, the president of the Washington Student Association, says that was true for some of her friends. She says that requiring students to read and fill out the form may actually lead them to new opportunities.
For some students, seeing the amount of aid they qualify for may be the very thing that changes their understanding of what's possible. For me, as for many other students, the FAFSA made it possible to pursue my bachelor's degree.
Ferguson says plenty of financial aid is available through state and federal programs, but students must first apply for it. It's been 3 years since the first hearing for people who filed claims in the massive Camp Lejeune contaminated water settlement. But there still hasn't been a single trial. Thousands of veterans and family members who lived on the North Carolina Marine Corps base can sue the government under a law Congress passed in 2022. As Jay Price reports for the American Homefront Project, both the plaintiffs and judges are growing frustrated.
The judges said from the beginning that getting the settlements done quickly was critical. People were exposed to the tainted water from 1953 to 1987, which means many are not only sick, but elderly. Jason Johns, the head of the VFW's National Legislative Committee, spoke at a recent rally at the Capitol. He said one law firm is representing about 2,000 plaintiffs, and nearly 10% of those have died in the past 2 years.
Next year, it's going to be 20%. The year after that, it's going to be 30%. If DOJ continues to do what it's doing, in 5 to 10 years, there'll be nobody left.
In an interview, he blamed the delays mainly on the Justice Department lawyers defending the Navy. He says they've been stalling, filing frivolous motions, including trying to relitigate the responsibility that Congress already admitted to in the 2022 law.
It creates an imbalance in the negotiations for settlements to say, you know what, yeah, I've only got so many years left, or my family's financially desperate, we need the money right now, we'll take a third of what we might have gotten 5 years ago.
While plaintiffs say they're jaded by years of delays, a recent sharply worded court order has given them at least some hope. The judges handling the thousands of lawsuits have ordered lawyers on both sides to hammer out a mass settlement plan by the end of October.
It's something. Do I have much confidence? We'll have to see what goes on with it. But it's something more than what we have had.
Jim Ward, who lives in Georgia, served at Lejeune in the early 1980s. He has an aggressive form of bladder cancer, and his wife has breast cancer. Both types of illness have been linked to the toxins in the water. Ward says he also believes the government lawyers are intentionally slowing progress to use the plaintiff's ages and illnesses as leverage for lowball settlement offers.
What a lawsuit means to you at 60 when you have some of your health, and what it means to you at 80 or 85 when your health is almost all gone because of illness, is two different things. You tend to settle for less, and you say, I'll do anything that y'all tell me.
The Department of Justice didn't respond to a request for an interview, but a former top DOJ litigator says he doesn't believe it would intentionally cause delays.
DOJ has no reason to drag it out. There's no there.
Paul Figley, now a law professor at American University, was with the DOJ for 30 years and served as deputy director of the torts branch, dealing with lawsuits against the government. He followed some of the early developments in the case and says he knows the lead government litigator.
He's not trying to cheat these people because he doesn't like them. He's just saying, this is the law. This is what you have to show. If you can't show it, then you shouldn't win.
Regardless of who's most at fault for the delays, plaintiffs like Jim Ward say it's time for them to end. He says the nation admitted in the 2022 law that it poisoned Marines and their families, and there's been more than enough time to decide which sick people should be compensated and how.
We don't need another 4 years, 3 years, 2 years of this being argued back and forth over who's right, who's wrong, the illnesses are wrong. Let's get this settled. Let's get it done. Let's get these people taken care of. Let's get them so they can continue with their healing.
The dozens of law firms representing plaintiffs are themselves represented by a small leadership group appointed by the court. The court's new order says they and the Justice Department lawyers must meet every week under the supervision of two court officials. If they don't reach an agreement by the October 30th deadline, the court may replace the plaintiffs' leadership group attorneys, and it threatened unspecified actions against the government defense team. I'm Jay Price reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. President Donald Trump addresses the nation on election security Thursday, June 16th at 9 p.m. Eastern. There are few details, but he's expected to speak on election machine security and will likely push the restrictive Save America Act. The timing is notable given the abrupt removal of three members of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission July 9th. A key function of the EAC is testing of voting machines and sharing that testing with state and local election officials. We've also reported that July 8th, the FBI surged 260 intelligence agents to complete the examination of Fulton County, Georgia's ballots and election records by July 17th. That followed an FBI seizure of voting machines in Puerto Rico in 2025, after which the Office of the Director of National Intelligence attempted to prove a conspiracy theory that the Dominion voting system's machines were vulnerable to foreign hacking. ODNI told Politico in February that analysts found, quote, extremely concerning cybersecurity and operational deployment practices that pose a significant risk to U.S. elections, unquote. Reputable election security experts remain skeptical that such vulnerabilities exist, noting that voting machines are controlled by local election officials and not connected to the internet. No widespread fraud has ever been found in the 2020 or subsequent elections. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.